Massa versus Ruff, and a petitioner may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Lee Hegner. I'm an assistant attorney general. I have asked for permission from Mr. Flewelling for 10 minutes of his time to present argument in this case on behalf of the division and the director. So I'm to be informed, I guess, when 5 minutes remain.
Well, you keep track of your time.
I'll do that.
The yellow light comes on as 10 minutes remaining.
Thank you. We believe that the Court of Appeals committed error when, contrary to the decision in Benevicius, it determined Workers' Compensation Rule of Procedure 11-2H is to be read to protract the definition of a conflict of interest beyond the interpretation of that rule by the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Excuse me. As this court specified in 2005 at Lovato, it reviews the proper construction of statutes de novo. And in so doing, it accords deference to an administrative agency's interpretation of its own statute, reserving to itself the right to take guidance from other statutory construction aids when an administrative agency's interpretation of a statute is neither uniform nor consistent. We suggest the rules here questioned are both uniform and consistent. It might be compelling were claimants' arguments offered here supported by facts which were derived from actual cases, wherein independent medical examinations rendered by physicians associated with contractually with but one of many worker compensation insurance providers have persistently been impeached. That record does not exist. No such evidence has been offered. No such argument has been advanced. Rather, the claimant contends, first, all physicians affiliated with a particular worker compensation insurance provider must be presumed to be motivated by bias. And second, physicians who are members of that provider physician's advisory group perform quasi-judicial acts, as a result of which those physicians must be required to disclose the extent to which their bias has been purchased. We believe the statutory language is clear, and this court should apply excuse me, the plain and ordinary meaning of the statute.
Standard?
Sir?
What is the word, statutory word, independent meaning? Your opinion? This is an independent medical examination, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. What's independent mean? And do you think that there at least is an appearance of conflict if someone has 25% of their income owing to a party in the case? Oh. Does that have any reflection on what is independent?
Mr. Justice Bender, the process has been established to allow for, consistent with the rules, the selection of a physician who has no relationship with any other physician in the case, and she is therefore independent of those physicians. And
so in other words, the independence you're talking about is different than the kind of independence that I think of when you think of independent medical exam. What you're saying is you're defining it in a very narrow subset, right?
I think that's a fair interpretation of what I'm saying.
You should follow the administrative interpretation.
Yes.
What about just common sense?
Well, that, again, common sense is, if you're suggesting that the exercise of common sense suggests that there is bias, I don't agree with you.
I don't know if there's bias or not.
All right.
But there certainly is an appearance of bias. I mean, let's take an example. Suppose you and I are in a little civil dispute, right? When we go before someone, we go before an arbitrator. And it turns out that arbitrator has 25% of his or her income from one of my family trusts. Are you going to be happy with that person as an arbitrator?
I'm happy with a procedure that says it leaves to the arbitrator the determination of whether or not he or she is so influenced by that income, by the receipt of that income, that neither he nor she can render a decision above suspicion or that is without bias. The other side of the 25% argument is that 75% of the income is derived from other sources. I'm not sure that it's okay, but we're presuming here something else, a fact, which does not exist in the record.
Why do we have to presume?
Because we're presuming that in this case, Dr. Ashberger was a member of only one preferred provider network.
Well, 25% is a lot of money, so that's
perhaps he had
$100,000. But how could you prove bias? You have to prove bias. What would be bias? 90% of the income?
Well, you would prove bias very easily, I think, Justice Bender, by showing a history of cases in which impairment ratings were entered by physicians who were members of one preferred provider network. And that characteristically, every one of those impairment ratings was overcome by clear and convincing evidence. The bias must find an expression. It must be palpable. It must be evident. And the way you prove it, I suggest, is to say, as we cannot find here, there's no evidence and no case that's been offered here to the effect that says, here are impairment ratings which have been entered by physicians associated with Pinnacle only through its SelectNet preferred provider program, and in every case these impairment ratings have been overcome. That would prove bias, and we don't have anything. There's not a case before you at this time which would indicate one, not one, where an IME and an impairment rating issued by a level two qualified physician through the process that has been adopted, promulgated by the director, has resulted in an invalid impairment rating. Doesn't exist. So my answer to your question, I'm sorry I'm taking so long, my answer to your question would be you'd find it by evidence in the record. This is, after all, an evidentiary proceeding.
Other parts of the statute or cases that we can look to for the definition of what independent means?
Other than the rules? Not to my knowledge. But we have a scheme here, as you well know, which says this is what the legislature wants done. It appoints the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation with the obligation of adopting rules. There's a rule that has been placed before this court for determination, and it's 2H. This is a matter that has been raised by the claimant in this case. 2H is a rule promulgated by the director, and it relates only to relationships between physicians.
Is it correct to understand the rules as basically defining conflict? 2H is what you're referring to there, which does define conflict, but not necessarily defining independence.
Once again, Justice Rice.
Sorry. 2H does define a conflict. That is, if one doctor had worked or had some kind of relationship with a physician who was treating the claimant, right?
2H, I believe, not to contradict you, but I believe that 2H says that a conflict can be presumed to exist when the circumstances expressed at 2H1, I believe, exist, where the definition of the specific interests, all of which relate to relationships between physicians exists. It does say, and I believe that we're here as a result of the fact that the phrase "not limited to" has brought us here today.
That actually gets, that is the question that I was asking, which is 2H says the conflict of interest includes, but isn't limited to, and then it gives us some examples.
Correct.
Alternatively, we don't seem to have a definition of independence as such, just of conflict. Is that correct? What an independent medical examination?
I believe that the structure of the rules that were adopted by the director, consistent with the statutory mandate, are intended to facilitate, as Mr. Justice Hobbs wrote in the Lobato case, to facilitate the handling of the number of accumulating ratings cases that are faced by the division.
Sure. I guess I'm not actually trying to ask that part of the question. So what's independent, the way this rule seems to be set up, is something where there's not a conflict?
It's independent, if I understand your question, and I hope that I do. We have the rule which states what a substantial relationship is between physicians involved in a business ownership, the interest of a creditor in an insolvent business, an interest in employment for which negotiations have begun, an ownership interest in real or personal property, a debtor's interest, or being an officer or director of a business.
I understand.
All right.
My question is really simple. There isn't a definition of independence. You know, like in regular personal injury cases, not workers' comp, you have an independent medical examination. I think that's the concept which is a little bit different than whether or not there is a conflict.
If the question is, does the rule define independent?
That's one of the
answers. No.
No, that's okay. So to be independent, the rule seems to suggest that there is no conflict. You're qualified unless you have a conflict to do an IMA in the workers' comp rules.
I'm not certain that I agree, because I think that there are certain presumptions that are made here. And I believe that we're in a froth over this issue of independence based on a presumption that, for which there is no support in the record, on the presumption that a person who is a member of one worker compensation insurance provider cannot be simultaneously a member of another, or a third, or a fourth. And what you are asked here to presume is the mere existence of a contractual relationship with Pinnacle is something should drive you to determine that it is something which is axiomatically, to use the claimant's word, axiomatically a function of bias, will result in bias. We have nothing here from which we can determine, nothing in the record to suggest that a person who is a member of SelectNet cannot at the same time be a member of any other preferred provider network.
Why do you think that's so important? Let's assume it's true that the doctor could be a member of three or four of them. So what conclusion would you draw from that?
You'd then be required to select or write a decision in this case, which would say that if a person derives 20% of his income from his participation in this preferred provider's network, 18% of his from this, 12% from this, you should presume there will be a bias in favor of the preferred, of the worker compensation insurance provider that provides most of his income.
Well, why wouldn't a more logical assumption be that if a physician is working for three or four providers, he can't do any IMEs that involve that provider, any of those providers? I would think that's more logical.
Can I ask them to disclose it and then it's up to the claimant to object?
I'm sorry?
Or just disclose the the work financial relationships, and it's up to the claimant to object?
Well, the predicate for that, Justice Bender, is that there are, in fact, not just there's a bias, but these are the renditions of quasi-judicial opinions. And the case that was cited by the claimant in this case for proof of his assertion involves the city council in Boulder County, which was clearly performing a statutorily required duty in passing the zoning regulation. It was a 106A4 action. There is nothing in this record, there is no case citation in this record, which suggests that a decision has been made earlier by any court in Colorado to the effect that the rendition of an impairment rating rendered by a qualified level 2 physician is a quasi-judicial act. It is nothing, but it raises nothing but a rebuttable presumption.
Do you think that system would be fair?
That is the system, and our argument is that it is no more than a rebuttable presumption. The argument that is made here by the claimant is similar to the tort argument res ipsa loquitur, related to a worker compensation insurance provider, axiomatically means bias. That's all that you're asked to conclude. That it exists, that it's something that you can make out of whole cloth. There are no decisions to support it. There's no case law to support it. It's the mere existence of this alleged fact. You're asked to rely on that without a record that is in any way compelling.
Can I ask you a question? This is what I suggested, maybe this is what you'd like us to do, is I think what you say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, was that the IME in this rule is solely defined not as you would in looking at what independence means in a dictionary, but consistent with the definition of conflict of interest under the rule, under
H2H.
Sorry. So is that what you're asking us for right
now? Yes, absolutely, because...
So it doesn't mean, the words don't mean that, but it's defined by the rule itself, period.
Well, I may make an inference to what you're saying that's inappropriate. This is a case that this very argument was raised in the Benoistus case. It was decided in the Benoistus case. The claimant's case is founded on a theory alone. The claimant's case is based on a theory that a member of a preferred provider network will be biased. Then he presumes, or asks you to presume, that the bias will result in an inappropriate impairment rating. Because even if there is a presumption of bias, the bias must result in an inappropriate rating.
I think that gets us back to where we started, and I have some difficulty with that, and that is the whole notion that this case would be different if the record had some indications of actual incorrect impairment ratings being done by the physicians who, you know, could have been questioned on this basis. But it doesn't seem to me we're talking here about actual inappropriate ratings. What we're talking about is how to prevent that. It seems to me that, and correct me if I'm wrong, even by your own argument, the statute says independent. That sort of is the basis for, or in part, for this Rule H. Although Rule H does not explicitly say this is independent, your argument is the rule has defined independent as no actual or appearance of conflict, as limited to how the rule goes ahead and gives examples of what would be conflicts. And so your argument is that's what's independent pursuant to the statute is what the rule defines as not being a conflict, essentially. Is that correct?
I think that's generally appropriate.
Now, you could have a lot of people, physicians who might have a conflict under this rule. You could argue about whether that will ever relate, result in in an improper or impaired rating. But regardless of that, they would still be, have conflicts, and they'd still be not independent. Isn't that correct?
Excuse me, if I can take a step back to try to clarify the argument. We're dealing with a statutory scheme. The legislature adopted the worker compensation statute. Certain undertakings were made by both sides relative to workers' compensation, with which this court is abundantly familiar. One of those leads to the fact that there is a director of the division of workers' compensation, and the statute charges the director with the promulgation of rules. What you are attempting to do, I believe, or what you're being asked to do, is to question the authority of the director to promulgate the rules. When the director promulgates rules to say, I have established a procedure for the selection of independent medical examiners.
Well, first of all, I don't disagree with you. No one's arguing about the authority to promulgate the rules.
Okay.
The first question that Justice Rice was trying to raise is, what do we do with the statute that says independent? Have the rules addressed it? And certainly it's arguable that they have not completely addressed it, that a conflict is not the only thing that amounts to independence. However, you, I think, are arguing, yes, it is. The rule addresses independent by defining conflict, right?
The process defined by the rule leads, in the minds of the director, to a method for selecting a physician who has no contractual relationship with any other physicians. And in the minds of the director, in the promulgation of those rules, that leads to an independent medical examination. That examination results in an impairment rating. The issue here is the impairment rating, its utility, its applicability, its reliability. We can argue about words all day and whether or not they're defined in a statute or in a dictionary. At the end of the day, when we finish making the sausage, we end up with a circumstance where we have an impairment rating. That's where we find whether or not the statute works, whether the implementation of the process by the director has been appropriate.
And the statute or the rules also have a whole lot of requirements for the physician in terms of numbers of hours of workers' compensation cases that the physician must handle and certification by the independent board on IMEs. I mean, are those all part of the attempts to define what is an independent?
They're part of the process which says we have physicians licensed by Colorado. That number is reduced substantially by those who want to do worker compensation work. If they want to do it, they must qualify as level two providers. If they qualify as level two providers, and it would be helpful with this court to know how many of the former morph into the latter, but that's not in the record. Of that, there are a number that are selected by the division to perform these evaluations. So that's part of the process as well. This is, in many ways, a self-qualifying statute. If you want to do this, you must abide by these rules, regulations, and restrictions. I've now taken almost all of Mr. Flewelling's time, and I apologize to him and to you. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Harvey Flewelling. I represent City of Manassa and Pinnacle Assurance. I basically agree with just about everything Mr. Hegner has argued and stated. In my limited time, I would say if I had to rely on anything as the authority to reverse the Court of Appeals below on the issue of whether Rule 11-2H applies to a dying physician's relationship with an insurance company, I would refer you to the director's order that's attached to my brief, where he explains pretty thoroughly the thought process and the statutory basis for the rule. And his interpretation of the rule, he wrote that this rule only prohibits dime physicians from performing the dime regarding conflicts of interest when they have a relationship with one of the treating physicians. And this is part, this rule recognizes the entire scheme, including the legislature's direction to the director to promulgate the rules, not only for division IMEs, but also for the accreditation of physicians.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
I take it the letter you're referring to is the November 16, 2007 letter?
I referred to that in my brief. I also attached to my brief is a director's order from November of 2009.
Let me just, if you have it in front of you, refer your attention to the November 16, 2007 letter.
I don't have it in front of me, but...
I'll read to you what I'm concerned about. He says that the rules were adopted, et cetera, et cetera. Then he says the rules are based on whether there is a conflict between the doctors involved in a particular claim. And it's, to me, that seems somewhat significant because 2H seems to be directed to whether a doctor who's doing IME has some sort of conflict with the treating doctor, where there's, if you will, kind of an internal conflict between the two doctors, such that one doctor might be concerned about evaluating the treatment of a colleague or the opinion of a colleague or something of that sort. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Assuming that that's a fair assumption, I'm more concerned about than the broader concern is from the claimant's perspective, not as between these two doctors and whether there might be a conflict, but from the plaintiff's perspective, there seems to be the absence of anything in the rule or anything else that would suggest that there's an appearance of impropriety from the claimant's perspective that the doctor himself, not vis-a-vis the doctor versus the treating doctor, but the doctor himself might have some kind of a conflict or an appearance of conflict by virtue of his relationship with the network.
Okay.
And that doesn't seem to be addressed at all by either the rule or by the letter from the director or anyone else.
The rule against conflicts of interest definitely doesn't address that. However, Rule 11-2E states that the division IME physician will not perform the dime if he cannot perform it impartially and objectively. So that goes to bias. That gives the claimant the ability to challenge the impartiality of the dime physician.
You think our focus on 2H is inappropriate in this case?
I think that the Court of Appeals below inappropriately analyzed the issue and didn't give great weight to the director's interpretation of his own rule. Another thing I want to point out is...
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but so you think we should be looking instead at 2A, the objective and...
Well, if you're concerned about the independence of the dying physician, the director has covered that with not only... I mean, that rule specifically says you must be impartial and objective. There's also other rules that ensure the independence of the dime physician, including even in the claimant's briefs, there parts of that rule also discuss prohibiting communications with the parties, or at least the insurance company.
No, I understand that, I saw that, but I'm more concerned about the appearance to the claimant of somehow, how are we guaranteeing that the claimant is good and objective and impartial IMA? And you said that we should look at 11-2E.
Yes, that would address that concern, and that would allow an administrative law judge to determine whether the opinion of the dying physician is overcome by virtue of the fact that there may be a bias or a partial opinion. That's, at least according to the director's order, I believe that's what he prefers to occur under his procedures. And again, the legislature didn't define independent. They didn't give him much guidance at all in promulgating these rules. And he has to work within the system, which actually requires insurance companies to have managed care networks. And that's what SelectNet is. And these managed, in, It's in 842.101.3.6 that requires every employer or insurance carrier in most of the larger counties in Colorado to offer medical case management or managed care, and it defines managed care as a network of medical providers accredited to practice workers' compensation. So this network is composed of accredited physicians. It just so happens that to perform a division IME, you have to be accredited. So there's a limited, I mean, that's the policy behind the director's rule, is the limited amount of physicians that are accredited that can perform impairment ratings and division IMEs.
Well, let me ask you this. Given your reference to 11.2E, does that provide the administrative law judge the ability here to actually take into account additional circumstances, facts that indicate bias when this is used in the process?
No question that the ALJ can infer a bias from certain facts, such as how much income a physician might make from a party or some other relationship they may have.
Well, that's the safety valve, and I should proceed.
Yes. Thank you.
May it please the court, Francis Concilia, and with me is Mr. Mullins, but I'll be handling the argument on behalf of Mr. Ruff. The director cannot promulgate a rule that eviscerates and guts the statute. The statute is really clear. It says independent medical examination. And if you go back to the history in 1991, the reason the legislature put this in place is up until that point, everybody was going out and hiring their own hired gun. So you would have two experts bought and paid for by each side. And the legislature hoped that it would be a more neutral, a more seemly procedure if there was a division independent medical examiner. And that was the purpose of it. Unfortunately, the director, with the help of the 800-pound gorilla Pinnacle, has completely eviscerated through its interpretation and promulgation of this Rule 11. And I don't believe that the director has any authority to promulgate a rule. And if you look at this, you know, as I was reading through all these cases over the past couple of days, I realized that the arguments that the director and Pinnacle are making almost make my head hurt. The argument goes like this. You have a division independent medical examination, but it doesn't really mean independent because we can put a rule in place. The rule says independent medical examination, but when you get down to the subpart as we're defining conflict of interest, the only thing we're referring to is a relationship between the treating doctor and the dime. And oh, by the way, if you use the statutory construction phrase of nociter, I apologize to Justice Hobbs, my Virgil and Aeneid is not very good, nociter associus, then we say the statute is maybe ambiguous or the rule is ambiguous, and therefore we look at other things, and it include but not limited to doesn't really mean independent. I mean, if I had been a betting woman after the argument in front of Benutius, I would have never thought that the Court of Appeals in Benutius would have gone to a phrase like nociter associus to say independent doesn't really mean independent other than a relationship between these two folks. I also disagree with what Mr. Hegner said as to whether or not there is any case law in this district, or in this state, excuse me, as to whether or not this is a quasi-judicial function. I don't think this court needs to look any further than the statute and the word that says independent, your decision in the Whiteside case, and I would also suggest you read the Caperton versus Massey Cole case from the United States Supreme Court to understand what the appearance of conflict of interest means so we can get to the remedy that I'm going to ask you to impose. In the Whiteside case, Justice Bender pointed out that the General Assembly had created the dime within the statutory scheme because of the potential for the treating physician to be biased in favor of the employer and the insurance company. And this court found that the General Assembly created the substantive right to workers' compensation, and that once a property interest has been created by statute, as is the case here, the 14th Amendment constrains the government from depriving people of their property interest without due process. Justice Coates' concurring opinion goes on to point out that procedural due process rules are shaped by the risk inherent in the truth-finding process as applies to the generality of cases, not the rare exception. And I believe what Justice Coates was pointing out was that to worry about whether or not an indigent could pay or not pay the fee, which this court made its ruling on, really didn't get to the substance, the substantive due process issue. And so we now have a case presented for decision by this court that gets to the generality of the cases, not the rare exception. Because, and I believe that Justice Coates, and I'm always reluctant to quote back to a sitting judge a line from their opinion, I believe Justice Coates in a footnote also commented that it is to the courts or other quasi-judicial official bodies that we ultimately look for implementation of a regularized, orderly process of dispute settlement. This is a very regularized process that Pinnacle and the director have engaged in. They and this group of doctors who enter into contracts with Pinnacle and receive from Pinnacle regular and generous steady income have prevented and interfered with the very independence. There is no way you can be independent if you are getting 25% of your income from someone, especially not in this day and age. 25% for most companies is your profit margin. And if you are getting that kind of income, you cannot be independent.
Can you comment on whether or not the division, given your view of the case, to come up with medical practitioners who are qualified to do this work who don't take and are these plans? I mean, you're seeming to suggest that you need to have a doctor or a series of doctors that really don't participate in doing cases that's paid for by any of these plans that they come into to play in this whole scheme.
What we are saying that you cannot be a division independent medical examination, you cannot perform that if you are getting, have a contractual relationship with any party, including Pinnacle. And that means you can't have a contractual relationship when Pinnacle is a party to the dispute. You can't have a contractual relationship with a claimant who is a party to the dispute.
Okay, so who are the doctors that can do this under your view of the case?
I believe there are doctors who can do this. They are correct that we haven't had fact-finding on that, but I don't think that's for this court to decide. I think what this court needs to decide is, what does independent mean? And you gauge independence and the appearance of a conflict of interest as well as the actual conflict of interest before the fact-finder, and that's what these dime doctors are, make their decision. I'm a pretty aggressive cross-examiner. I don't think I could cross-examine these doctors to beat them into submission and say, yes, you got me, Ms. Consilia. I'm going to lie, cheat, and steal for my 25%. They all think they're independent. But the fact of the matter is, you are not independent when you are bought and paid for and you get this kind of a stream of income from someone.
Well, I mean, hold on. How about medical ethics, the medical board, the other kinds of ethics that apply to a physician? I mean, doesn't that come into play in any of this too? And how about the safety valve, the administrative law judge or hearing officer, in fact, is the one in the quasi-judicatory role ultimately?
As it has been applied, it is not a safety valve. Mr. Mullins attempted to cross-examine and attempted to call a witness at the actual hearing in which this dime doctor, Dr. Ashberger, attended. And the administrative law judge said that he was bound by the motion for protective order in which Mr. Mullins had filed before the dime doctor did his examination, asking that he be prohibited from doing it because of the financial relationship. The administrative law judge handling the final matter told Mr. Mullins he could not go into any of that, and he could not argue, and he could not call a witness whom he had testified because he had bound by the discovery dispute. So what they're telling you is going to be a safety valve is not a safety valve. And if you look at the attachment which counsel quoted you to in their opening brief, you can get an and that's the November 2009 letter that has the redacted claimant's name on it. You can get a real insight into the mindset of the director. And he's not going to do anything on this until you call balls and strikes and tell him what to do. You know, the reason
I guess what I'm concerned about is, are you asking for a better mechanism of a hearing so that an individual doctor's independence can be tested?
No.
Are you asking for a broader remedy?
We are asking for a broader remedy. And if you look at the amicus brief filed by Mr. McDonald, who is sitting in the courtroom here, on behalf of the Workers' Compensation Education Authority, at the very end of it, he points out the remedy, and that's the remedy I think you should impose in this case, is that if there is this contractual relationship, they don't get to do the dime.
What does that do to the rule of necessity argument?
Well,
just underlying, I think, Justice Hobbs' concern. There aren't any doctors who can do this.
They've taken inconsistent positions. First, they say, we don't keep statistics like this, so we don't know how many of these doctors would have to disqualify themselves. Then, on the other hand, they say, well, because of the rule of necessity, this is going to be a disaster. If we're correct, and if they have tainted this independent neutral in that fashion, there should be consequences. That is not something that you should use as an excuse for them to continue this. That's like someone who kills their parents arguing for the mercy of the court because he or she is an orphan. I mean, if they have tainted the process in this fashion with impunity over the last 10 years, that's a problem for them. I don't think it's that bad, and I do believe that there are doctors who are going to be able to perform the independent medical examinations who do not have these contractual relationships.
Should it matter for us whether the legislature intended to delegate this kind of a balance to the ICAO, to the director, we all seem to be agreeing, however it would come out, if it is a question of practicalities of licensing, a number of people available, the number of IMAs that would have to be done, versus to what extent do we have a likelihood that somebody would be biased, would be influenced in favor of one party or the other. Should we be concerned with whether the legislature intended to allow a particular body with some expertise to make that kind of a judgment?
I think it is one of the things you should take into account. However, I do not think that the legislature has given them, in this statute, the ability to eviscerate the concept of independence. I mean, the concept of independent and neutrality is something that you use common sense to determine. You know, lawyers and judges take such a bad rap. And the older I get, the more impressed I am with how good we are and the rules that we have in place for ourselves, how good they are in terms of ensuring neutrality and fairness and proper advocacy. You know, Pinnacle and this group of doctors have done what you and I cannot do. You wouldn't sit in a case in which you got any of your income, let alone 25% of your income, from a litigant in front of you. Most of you won't go out to lunch with an attorney and let the attorney pay for the lunch because you know that there could be the appearance of impropriety. I can't take a case, or if I did, you'd take my license, if I was getting 25% of my income from a party adverse to my client. And I'm an advocate, not a neutral. For those of you who were trial judges, you wouldn't allow a juror to sit on a case who was getting 25% of their income from a litigant before them. I wouldn't hire an expert to be an expert in a case that was getting 25% from the opposing party. I mean, so their argument here that because they have written a rule and have a subpart to it, and they have a fancy Latin phrase, that somehow that has to trump the legislature's creation of the Division Independent Medical Examination and what you all decided in 2003 in the Whiteside case just boggles my mind. Virgil must be rolling in his grave to think that a Latin phrase, which is a beautiful language, can be used in this fashion. I mean, independent means independent. And I would urge you to look at the Caperton versus Massey Cole case. You know, as I was watching that case percolate up through the United States Supreme Court, I was scratching my head as to how it ever got there. I mean, how can Mr. Blankenship, a man who's become infamous in the last 4 weeks, of Massey Cole, contribute $3 million to defeat a judge, to get Judge Benjamin elected? And how could Judge Benjamin say, I can be independent, and then reverse the $50 million award against Massey Cole that had been entered by a jury on a 3-2 decision? I mean, you sit there and you say, are we all crazy? How could anybody say he's independent? But that judge did. And the United States Supreme Court had to take it and to call balls and strikes. And what Justice Kennedy said in that case is that even though Justice Benjamin was not receiving the funds personally, which is different than in this case, the doctors are getting these funds personally, the probability of actual bias on the part of the judge or decision maker is too high to be constitutionally permissible. And he went on to conclude that an extensive search of Justice Benjamin to search his soul and determine he was not biased is only one step, and that you need an objective standard.
Can I interrupt? I'm sorry.
You always can. You're
always so practical. But so I was just looking at this brief to see what remedy that the amicus wanted. If I'm reading it correctly, they're suggesting that we find a hold as a matter of law that 25% is a conflict, and therefore there is an act of independence. Is it your position that we be that numerical, that we be that precise, or is it your position that if there is any amount of income, there is a showing of conflict? Where do you fall on that kind of spectrum?
I have been thinking about that over the last few days, and I would suggest that you should not remand this for further fact-finding on this issue. My suggestion is that there is a contractual relationship between the dying doctor and the insurance company involved in the litigation, Pinnacle in this case, that is disqualifying, cannot be the dying doctor. And in this particular case, the dime doctor disagreed with the treating physician. There's a disagreement as to MMI. There's disagreements as to surgery. And quite frankly, Dr. Ashberger should not have been the dime physician. And you know, if you look at it from the point of view of the claimant, the claimants thought that there was, and the workers' comp bar, that there was a compromise. Not everyone was happy with the dime procedure. They, you know, there was give and take on it when the legislature enacted it. But the thinking was that you would pay your $675 and you got an independent neutral to decide this. And make, you know, no bones about it, the dime doctor is the fact finder. He's not just an expert. You can only overcome that by clear and convincing. And it means it is almost impossible to overcome because you can't develop efficiently clear and convincing expert that there was a mistake there.
In all due regard, it seems to me you merged appearance of conflict into an actual conflict here.
Yes.
I'm a little bit concerned about the ramification of the kind of remedy that's being asked for.
Okay.
The one that has to address was trying to clarify on other situations involving administrative agencies and decision-making. It seems to me you're suggesting that we basically rewrite the rule and redesign the system for the director.
No. Well, I think his rule is so fundamentally flawed and so unfair that you should give it no deference. Because it is a question of law as to whether or not
we're not the rulemaking agency, are we?
You determine balls and strikes as to who is independent and who can be the neutral making these decisions.
Well, we just got one case in Marinus involving whether or not there's a sufficient conflict to throw out this particular medical examination.
You have
rather than a case of us trying to reform the entire system that's alleged to be corrupt based on the appearance of a conflict of interest.
It is true you have one case, but you know what their position is, Your Honor. And then the question becomes, is 24% going to be okay? Is 23% going to be okay? Is 22% okay? I mean, with respect to Mr. Ruff, yes, the decision should be, under these circumstances, this doctor cannot be the division independent medical examiner. But I think you should go further than that, because the director and that 800-pound gorilla Pinnacle have fiddled and diddled with this law, with their interpretations and their refining of it for the last 10 years. And as a result, claimants don't get justice, and they don't have a lot of faith in the system. And that is appalling. That is truly appalling. Part of this bargain under the workers' compensation system is that there is supposed to be a neutral making these findings. And make no bones about it, this doctor makes decisions as much as a trial judge would. And I understand, Justice Hobbs, that there is a concern as to what could this morph into. But I think that the division independent medical examiner is such a narrow animal, if you will, where they are entitled to great deference, their findings cannot essentially be overcome, that I don't think you have to worry about it morphing into other areas of the law, if that is your concern.
Could I ask another question, please?
Yes.
Why isn't 11-3 a sufficient safeguard? Well, let me ask the question differently. In essence, what you're asking us to hold is that 11-2-E is not, and I emphasize, as a matter of law, a sufficient safeguard.
Correct.
And that's fairly broad request for relief. Why would we, with respect to this record, be in a position to hold that as a matter of law?
Well, first, I would note that ICAP and Pinnacle argued that 11E was not before the court, only 11H, which says not evaluate an IME claimant if the occurrence and the language you've been through. But as a practical matter, what you would be doing is buying into the position of the director in his November 09 letter, which says you analyze it after the fact. That does not give a claimant a sense that when he or she paid his $675, he was really getting someone fair and impartial.
Sorry, interrupting yet again. What do you mean by after the fact? After the decision is made? When does that action work out?
I believe it would only be after it was the IME was conducted, and I believe that's what the director is arguing for in that letter, Exhibit A, attached to Pinnacle's opening brief.
I thought that you had a kind of doctor before.
Well, that's what Mr. Mullins has done and has been doing. He's been objecting to it before, and the ALJs in Benutius, in these other cases, are consistently saying we are bound by Rule 11 and this interpretation that the director has had. So you've got this sort of circular argument here that it's okay. It's okay if you get 25% of your income. It's okay if you have a contractual relationship. And it is not okay. There is nothing fair or impartial about it. And I believe that the decision you all made in 2003 in the Whiteside case is that there is a substantive...
Do you have any evidence in this record that this particular position has actually fudged bias given opinions on other cases that and slavishly adhere to the insurance company's position and are not exercising its medical ethics and its duty to the forum?
Mr. Mullins was not allowed to go in that at the time the dime doctor presented his testimony, because the judge found that he was bound by the discovery dispute. I would phrase it more of a discovery dispute, the procedural dispute that Mr. Mullins raised. Mr. Mullins objected to this doctor doing the dime because he found out all three of them have the relationship with Pinnacle. And, you know, I understand, Justice Hobbs, that you come from the water law background, and these kinds of conflicts are dealt with in the water bar usually fairly well. I think this is a whole different kind of animal, because...
I guess I need to understand more about what this discovery dispute is.
Mr. Mullins had at first objected to letting Dr. Ashberger conduct the dime.
Then he wanted to discover what this physician had done in other cases and was not allowed to?
I don't know the answer to that, if that was actually questioned or not. He had presented testimony to the first ALJ that based on the income level that he had, he shouldn't be allowed to do the dime. And that was, the ALJ found that the Dr. Ashberger could conduct the dime. And then after the dime was done and they get to the final hearings, Mr. Mullins was prevented from calling a witness and from introducing the AMA ethical guidelines.
What was the remand that you wanted? Why was that?
In order to really analyze and get to some of the complaints that the director has asserted, there could be some additional factual record, because the Court of Appeals had suggested that you had to go back for an analysis of not only the actual subjective conflict, but the appearance of impropriety. But as I've looked at this, read the various pleadings, and looked at the position of the Workers' Compensation Education Association, and looked at Exhibit A to Pinnacle's brief, I think the only way you can really move this forward is to find that there is a, it is disqualifying for a doctor to conduct the dime when he has a contractual financial relationship with a party to the litigation.
How do we even know in this case that he has, that the doctor has a 25% income?
I believe that was the evidence in the record below. Admitted that. He said that at the hearing.
But he admitted that in the context, I guess, of...
Hearing number one.
What you're referring to is the discovery hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
Also, can I, before you move on, can I just bring you back to E?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but I guess I'm just... Maybe you've already said this, but I guess I'm wondering, is it your position that E cannot take care of this sort of 25% issue under any circumstances, or it just did not take care of it in this case because you were prevented from presenting the evidence?
I don't think it can prevent it in any case.
And help me understand that.
Because a claimant who is having something as important as MMI and degree of impairment, which is the whole ballgame in the workers' comp, as you recognized in the Whiteside case, that's it. It should not be conducted by anyone who has a financial relationship with a party, with the insurance company that's in that case.
And I'm wondering, I guess you're reading E to mean that you could never bring that up at the beginning, that it couldn't be something that was brought up at the beginning, that it always has to be under the language of E, something proven. Is that correct?
Because that makes it a very inefficient, burdensome process for a claimant every time to be challenging this. And, you know, workers' compensation claimants' lawyers and the insurance defense bar don't get rich on these cases. You get a percentage. And it's how much time you're going to be putting into this in terms of challenging again and again and again this concept of independence. They're not independent. I mean, we might as well then go back to the process where everybody hires their own hired gun. At least you know what you're paying for then.
So then why am I asking a parallel question with age? I mean, why doesn't that, with age, as read by the Court of Appeals in this case, resolve your concerns?
Because that does not really define what independence means. It talks about the appearance or an actual conflict of interest. Do I think the Ruff Court of Appeals got it a whole lot better than the Benuchas Court of Appeals? Yes. I still don't understand how they got sort of foobarred by this concept of nascitur associis. But Claimants in these cases...
Well, I think more specifically, it seems as though a possible interpretation of H is that it's implementing, at least in part, the requirement for an independent medical examiner, and that independent is therefore implicitly defined as, you know, absent any actual or appearance of conflict. So why is it that?
Because the director's not going to apply it in that fashion without clear direction from this court.
So you think if that's the case, then that may result in further rules which narrow appearance of conflict beyond what the Court of Appeals here may have seen as being?
Yes. And it just means that this process goes on and on and on. They've devised a very efficient process for them and for Pinnacle. It's just not efficient for the claimants, and it doesn't have the appearance of being independent and fair. And workers who have given up a lot in terms of their tort rights under the workers' compensation statute have some rights, and they can't be regarded as somebody who's just helping to grease the wheels of an efficient running through of this process. This rule and how it has been applied violates the appearance of impropriety.
Doesn't the proceeding before the administrative law judge, I mean, the attorneys are pretty specialized part of doing this kind of work. Can't they bring out evidence about the impairment rating and, go after its credibility?
Well, you have to
have a case. I mean, the typical engine of convincing a quasi adjudicatory or adjudicatory decision maker that this particular examination is not credible. It's not worthy. It's not, it has to be redone.
I don't think so, Your Honor, especially not with the position that the director has taken, who has been very much on the side of Pinnacle throughout all of these disputes.
It's almost as if you're arguing the administrative hearing officer really has no role in actually determining what the impairment rating should be, I mean, or reviewing that. I mean, is that really the way the statute is structured?
That really is, Your Honor, because you can't overcome the dime doctor's conclusions other than by clear and convincing evidence, which means after you paid the $675, then you've got to go hire somebody else who's going to spend hours and explain what's wrong with it. I mean, this is wrong. You couldn't do it. I can't do it. You shouldn't let them do it.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be